Hey, I'm Kelly Corrigan, and wondering is definitely my favorite pastime. Like, I wonder, how does change actually happen for a country, for a family, for a person? What sets us back? What sets us up? Can we swap in a good habit for a bad habit? Who do we need on the trail with us? And why, in some cases, is love not enough to change a person? I'm super glad you're here. Kelly Corrigan Wonders is a place for people who like to laugh while they think and aren't afraid to look at ourselves and our weird ways in the hopes that knowing more and feeling more will help us do more and be better. So let's get to it. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states and situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Hey, this is Kelly Corrigan, and today I'm wondering about how change really happens in the lives of individuals. So I went looking for someone who has undergone tremendous change over many years, and I discovered Rich Roll. Rich Roll, as you may know, is a man of many lives. He was, way back, a kid on the edge of the playground with an eye patch and a book who became a Stanford swimmer and someone who really couldn't talk to a girl without being blind drunk. He confessed in this conversation that he's blacked out and driven drunk more times than he can bear to count, maybe 1,000. He also swam butterfly at Stanford, went to an Ivy League law school, lost 50 pounds, won a whole bunch of Ironmans and ultramarathons. He's written a few best-selling books and started an insightful gut punch of a podcast 8 years ago that is endlessly interesting and valued by millions of people. I wanted to talk to Rich because of all the people I know, he has changed a lot over many years and after so much suffering and destruction, and I couldn't help wondering how he did it. Hey, Rich Roll.
How's it going, Kelly Corrigan?
I'm good. It's sort of funny to turn the tables on you. You were like the first big-time podcast I was ever on, and it was
so fun.
And my husband said, I don't think you've talked to me that long in like 5 years. And there you are, like 2 hours into it with this guy. Isn't that insane?
It's crazy.
So we're doing this 10-part series on how change happens with the assumption that this is a story that we need to be reminded of over and over again, both at a societal level, at a global level, that things do change, like civil rights and the environment and end-of-life practices and higher education. And then we also desperately need to be reminded that individual lives change. Mm. So I thought that you would be a pretty perfect person to talk about personal change with, since you have sort of had a radical double life. So can we just go to high school and tell the story of Rich Roll's life? Like, this is it. For the record, this is the story of your life.
I'm feeling the pressure.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
On.
Normally, with these podcasts, I'm pretty laid back. But going into this, I'm like, oh, man, Kelly's going to come ready to go. I better be on my game.
I'm not going to hold back.
Yeah.
So tell me, who were you in high school? Describe your the role you played.
I was a pretty bookish, quiet, insecure kid who really struggled to feel a part of anything. I was challenged in making friends in elementary school. You know, I was the outcast on the playground who wasn't getting picked for kickball. I probably didn't help that I had an eye patch on one eye and headgear, orthodontia.
Why did you have an eye patch?
I have a weak eye. My left eye is weak. And the thinking was that if you put a patch on my strong eye that it would make my weak eye stronger, but it didn't really work other than to humiliate me for a couple of years as a young person.
You had to wear it for years?
On and off for a couple of years. Yeah, throughout like elementary school primarily.
So what town did you grow up in?
I grew up in Bethesda, just outside Washington. My dad was a government lawyer, and, you know, we kind of had this inside the beltway experience.
Mm-hmm. Do you have brothers and sisters?
One sister who's 2 years younger.
And was she a cool kid?
She, you know, she's in certain ways very different from me, but also similar. She followed in my footsteps and became a swimmer as well. She lived in Denver for many years, and she just recently moved back to Washington.
Was swimming the first thing that you felt proficient in?
Yes, 100%. I mean, it was the one thing that I actually had some level of ability in. And as a young person trying to figure out my place in the world, that was one place where I had some success, not a lot, but a little bit, enough to encourage me or nudge me in that direction. And it really became my first love affair, probably also my first addiction, and kind of a safe haven from the confusing emotions I was experiencing as a young person.
And what books did you love when you were a young bookish guy on the edge of the playground?
You know, the typical Catcher in the Rye. Ugh. Probably my Bible as a young lad.
Yeah, little Holden Caulfield.
Feeling a little alienated.
Yeah, The Great Outsider.
Yeah.
Was swimming even for you then meditative, or was it like deeply competitive?
Probably a little bit of both. My relationship with it was, like I said, this safe haven. Like when my head was underwater, it was muting out all of the noise, and I could just be with myself, and I felt safe and protected. But I was also competitive, and it also provided community for me. Like I was more interested in making friends than beating other people. Like I wanted to win, but not to beat other people, but to be better than I was the day before. And the community that I found in the pool with the various teams that I, you know, was a member of over the years really became my social life. You know, my social life was not at school. It was with the kids that I was with in the water.
And did you like yourself as a kid, and then you were sort of confounded that other people didn't? Or did you decide that not being popular meant that you were dislikable?
I don't think I actively disliked myself. I was fairly comfortable with who I was, but I was confused and in some pain that I had trouble connecting with other kids.
Yeah.
And I think on top of that, there was a layer of parental expectation about excelling academically. It's sort of like this unspoken understanding that you were going to do these certain things and you were going to be this person in school. And, you know, we're kind of creating the foundation for this life that we're heavily invested in. And I carried that weight on my shoulders and took it seriously, but it was kind of at odds with my natural disposition. And so I was always trying to reconcile, you know, kind of how I felt vis-a-vis this person that I was being ushered to become.
And who was that?
I mean, the expectation was you will excel at school, and the options were, you know, the typical, you know, lawyer, doctor route for the most part. You know, I was a kid who liked to be in the school play and liked to draw and, you know, be by myself. And I think that was confusing for my parents, and, you know, they did the best they can. And I love my parents and we have a great relationship, but they were definitely, you know, of the mind that, you know, I was going to be, you know, headed in a particular direction. And I fell into line with that. Like I wanted to please them and satisfy that expectation, even at the cost of what it was that perhaps, you know, I could have done otherwise.
Who or what did you love the most when you were 15 years old?
Well, I started to idolize all the great swimmers. I can remember looking forward to getting Swimming World magazine in the mail every month, and I had a big stack of them on my bedside table.
And did you have a best friend? Did you have a person that you loved who loved you back?
No. I did not have a best. I had some friends, but I didn't have a best friend.
Yeah. I think that's so hard. I mean, we're both parents of teenagers now. And so you see your childhood. It's so informative for you to have compassion for your children and what big, huge experiences they're going through, even though you know that the world awaits. Like when you're 9 and you don't have a best friend, when you're 15 and there isn't one person who's got your back, yeah. That is really traumatic on a daily basis for people.
Yeah. Our oldest daughter has that sorted out. She's a social animal and has tons of friends and is very close with her inner social circle. And then our other daughter is more like I was at that age, like to herself in her bedroom. She has friends, but she doesn't have that confidant.
Yeah.
And as a parent, you do feel like you want to fix that. You want to solve that for them. And it's always this calculus that you're running about how involved do you get versus how much do you kind of stand back and allow them their own process.
Okay. So when did you have your first drink?
First time I really got drunk was on a recruiting trip to the University of Michigan, where I was at a party with a bunch of the swimmers after a dual meet. And it made a huge impression on me because I was amongst all of these people that I revered and respected who were welcoming me into their community. And the beer that was handed to me initially was by a guy called Bruce Kimball, who was, other than Greg Louganis, was the most successful diver in the country at that time.
I was a diver, yes.
Were you a diver? Do you remember Bruce Kimball? Do you know
totally.
Who he is? Yeah. So he handed me a beer and we were partying and he became my buddy that evening. And for those who know who he is, know the story well. Like, he became an alcoholic and ended up in prison after careening his car while he was drunk driving into a crowd of people, killing an individual. And, you know, his life got completely derailed as a result of his relationship with alcohol. So that was my auspicious introduction to drinking.
And so you got hammered. You go to sleep somewhere at University of Michigan. You wake up the next morning and your thought is,
where can I do more of that as often as possible? I was functional for a long time, but I was still the guy who would, you know, drink the most at the party and, you know, do the most embarrassing thing and leave last and be unable to get up in the morning, or, you know, was in a blackout and all the kind of stuff that happens throughout college that you can kind of write off because you're in college and this is what college kids do. So that's where you begin to develop this veneer of denial over the truth of your behavior. And, you know, I lived in that denial space for a long time. But the truth is, looking back on it retrospectively, you know, all the evidence was there from the beginning that my relationship with this substance was dysfunctional and unhealthy. It just took 15 years for it to completely capsize my life to such an extent that I was willing to actually do something about it.
When you were getting hammered at Stanford and still swimming, right? You were a butterfly swimmer at Stanford?
Mm-hmm.
Were you in conversation with yourself about your behavior and a need to change, or were you just turned completely away from it?
I knew in my heart of hearts that my relationship with alcohol was different than other people. There was one time where I tried to not drink for a month prior to a big meet, and I think I made it a week, and I knew, like, wow, I can't even go a week. And that just gets kind of filed away, but it didn't really change how I was behaving. But there was kind of this slow growing sense that, you know, this is not good.
And how were your grades in college?
I got A's in some classes, but I was pretty much like a B+ student. So I could function at a pretty high level. And I could still, no matter what I did, you know, get up in the morning and go to morning swim practice and just do it hungover while I smelled like a distillery. But what happens is there's a weird ego thing that starts to occur with that, like this Superman complex, like I can go out and party harder than anyone else and I can still go to swim practice and I can still get A's in this class and show up. Nobody's got nothing on me. Like, I can do all of these things better than everyone else. So you start to develop that perverted complex, but you're also starting to feel worse and worse and worse about yourself. So you're harboring these simultaneous ideas of being better than everyone else and being an utter piece of who's worthless and, you know, shouldn't have the right to breathe air on the planet. And the ability to kind of simultaneously live in that space is something that's very unique to alcoholism, I think.
Did you have real friends in college? People who loved you, people who had your back?
Yeah. I mean, I found my community. I go from metropolitan Washington, where it's prep school and coat and tie, and it's all about lacrosse and football, to California, where the swimmers are the heroes on campus, which is the greatest thing ever. And the friendships that I made on that swim team are still some of my best friends today. So, you know, irrespective of how I was behaving, I really did find my community there, and I was really happy. And I have to say, as dysfunctional as my relationship with alcohol was and would grow to become, it also, you know, brought me out of my shell. Like, it taught me how to be a social animal in the world. I suddenly could go to parties and, you know, be like everybody else. Like, I had this rule book for life suddenly and felt comfortable, even though it was a false sense of comfort, a comfort in my own skin. And I think that allowed me to develop some social skills that I don't know that I would have, you know, developed otherwise. So it's not a black or white kind of binary thing.
Yeah. It's very generous of you to make that note. It's important that all the complexity be laid bare here, because I mean, sometimes I say in situations, this is what alcohol's for. You know, like when you end up in a deeper conversation that you would have, or when people are grieving terribly and then someone's like, can I get you a glass of wine? Or they're just like at their wit's end. You know, you go way back in time and you think, who invented this? Like, who figured out there's peyote and there's opium and there's this other way to feel different, to change the channel in your head? And used properly, it can have kind of medicinal benefits.
Yeah, 100%. Some genius figured it out, actually, you know.
Was there anyone in college who either was a terrible enabler who was like, dude, you're really going hard, like a little more than you probably should?
Yeah, I had both. And those messages were coming from not just single individuals, but a variety of people. I remember more the friends who were like, hey, do you think you could not drink when we go to this concert tonight? Than the friends who were egging me on, like, because those stuck out. They were rarer, but more impactful. And so I was starting to get these messages like, hey, man, what you're doing, you may think it's cool, but it's not that cool.
And did you find yourself surrounding yourself with other people who were hard charging partiers so that you could be like, you know, not stick out as like a up?
Yeah. I mean, I joined this, I call it a fraternity. It was like a drinking club of dudes who were known for being the hardest partiers on campus. And in that crowd, like, you know, I didn't stand out so much.
And did any of those other guys end up going to AA? And
yeah, of course.
Yeah. Okay. So after Stanford, you went to law school at Cornell.
I moved to New York City and I lived there for 2 years. And then I went to law school after that. So the drinking really progressed when I was in Manhattan.
Yeah. So tell me about that.
I worked in a law firm initially for like a year and a half, making almost no money. And I was just there to have a good time. The partying and the drinking really notched up there, because I think it's a very permissive environment to that kind of behavior. It's about being social and being out late and
city that never sleeps.
Yeah, basically. And you can walk down the street with a beer, you know, in a paper bag and no one bats an eye. And I just thought, this is Disneyland for what I'm interested in. And I loved it. And it just progressed and progressed and progressed. And I ended up going to law school upstate in Ithaca. And I remember thinking, I need this, like I need some stability. Like, I'm starting to get really out of control. And being in this bucolic town with a rigorous academic schedule is going to ground me and prevent me from really, you know, going off the rails. But that's what we call a geographic. You bring yourself with you, which you tend to overlook.
And are you having relationships? Like, are you falling in and out of love and all that kind of stuff?
A big part of the drinking was fueled by a lack of understanding around how to relate to the opposite sex. And I was very reliant upon alcohol to, you know, kind of allow me to connect with women. Like, I felt like I, without alcohol, I didn't even know what to say to a girl. So I was extremely dependent. And so I had short-lived relationships and one-night stands and all kinds of stuff over the years, but I was unable to really have a true relationship of honesty and intimacy until I got sober.
How accurate a picture did your parents, from the minute you started at Stanford to the minute you finished at Cornell, have about you and your life?
You know, they were proud of me that I went to Stanford and went to Cornell Law School and, you know, was able to land a job at a law firm. So they felt secure that their plan for me was, you know, headed in the right direction. But they started to realize, like, that, you know, I had a lot of problems. And, you know, mixed into all of this was, you know, this comes a little bit later, but a marriage that went sideways, and that revealed more of just how off the rails I had become. And they were trying to figure out how to communicate with me about that or express their concern. My mother, by definition, is a very fear-based person, somebody who's prone to a lot of anxiety, and this definitely ratcheted it up. And that sense of, like, powerlessness that comes with it, too. Like, they couldn't control me. They couldn't get me to change. And it wasn't until, this was some years later, but it got to the point where my dad just had to deliver the hard love and say, look, you're completely out of control. Like, we're terrified of what's going to become of you and how you're behaving. Something bad is going to happen and we can no longer abide. And we love you and we're here for you if and when you're ready to course correct and get sober. But until then, like, we just can't participate in this anymore and we don't want to hear from you. And that was really awful to hear, but also ultimately was the greatest act of love and kindness they could have given me, because I was so humiliated and so upset by that, that it helped snap that denial and connect me with the fact that I had a problem that was bigger than I wanted to admit to myself, and that if I didn't figure it out, things were going to get really bad really quickly.
Huge turning point.
Yeah. And they were going to Al-Anon and they were getting advice from other people. Like, they were trying to figure out on their end, like, how do we communicate with this guy? What are we supposed to do in this situation? It is a sense of powerlessness. And, you know, as somebody who's been now in the recovery space for well over two decades, I work with a lot of people and young people and parents who are in that position. And it's so hard to give advice because you want to swoop in and save the person. You want to do the right thing. And you feel like if you do nothing or deliver that hard love speech, that that person's going to disconnect from you, and then you really aren't going to be able to exert any positive influence on them. And it's terrifying. And I'm very empathetic to that. You know, I was lucky that in my case, I was able to hear that. It was delivered at a time where I was, you know, in a dark and desperate enough place to register it and ultimately, you know, not right away, but ultimately do something about it.
How did they know? How did they have visibility into your behavior?
I think the first instance where they realized this is highly problematic was when they came for my law school graduation. And I was essentially, you know, off my rocker the entire time and unable to just be present with them at all in a very selfish way. And they ended up leaving early. And that was a painful, painful experience. And then after that, in the wake of this marriage that essentially ended on the honeymoon and me kind of coming clean with my parents about what had happened with this relationship, my mom came out to visit me in Los Angeles with the idea being that we were going to return all these wedding gifts that had been delivered. And I was drunk the whole time, like during the day, you know, and it was very evident that this was something much deeper and darker than even they thought. And then my dad visited me on one occasion too. And, you know, I was getting drunk in the shower at like 9 o'clock in the morning and thinking that he wouldn't know, you know, and of course everybody knows. So it was just embarrassing and humiliating.
Let's take a short break, but quickly, can I shout out Brooke Che? She gave a great tweet about the show that I just caught. It says, listen to Kelly Corrigan Wonders and your shoulders will magically drop an inch lower. Thanks, Brooke, for posting about the show. We kind of live for that stuff. This episode was funded by the great people at the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. You can learn more about this fantastic organization at avdf.org, the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation's Investing in Our Common Future. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are just right for the role you've got. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. LinkedIn gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else, all the while making the process easy and intuitive. I mean, when you have that many quality candidates, hiring gets a lot easier. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. So maybe you're 24 hours from finding your perfect next hire. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/Kelly. That's linkedin.com/Kelly to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back. Before we return to Rich, I want to share that production support for Kelly Corrigan Wonders comes from the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, supporting inclusive higher education and healthcare, vibrant spiritual communities, and a clean environment. The Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, investing in our common future. Do you ever think, when you think about change and like the weird gears at work that are conscious and subconscious and unconscious, that sometimes people who want to change and don't know how do something so blatant that they know at some level it's going to bring in the troops? So, you know, you didn't have to get drunk that day that your mom was visiting, but do you ever think maybe there was some part of you that was like, somebody's got to see this?
Maybe unconsciously, there was some defense mechanism that was compelling me to behave that way. At the time, I think I was just in so much pain and had no tools for how to deal with it and no emotional maturity to navigate through it or to communicate with other people or to ask for help or to receive help. And my only mechanism was to completely numb out because I just couldn't stand the way that I felt about myself. And I couldn't stomach what had happened to my life. If I was drinking, then I wouldn't feel it. And I think it was as simple as that at the time.
This is a dumb question from a person who has not had this particular problem. And it goes to this larger idea about like the mystery that is self-esteem. How could you not feel good about yourself? You were amazing. You were a college athlete. You went to the top university in the country. You went to an Ivy League law school. You're handsome. You're talented. Like, what's to feel bad about?
I wish I knew the answer to that question.
I know, you know, right? Because you see it everywhere. I think self-esteem is so mysterious.
It really is. Yeah, obviously on paper, I had no reason to feel poorly about myself. But I think it is more complicated than that. Packed into it is this imposter syndrome. Like, I don't deserve to be here. I only got in here because of this happened or that happened. And that kind of fundamental disposition of feeling apart from or separate from others, feeling isolated, always made me feel like all these people seem to understand life and they feel comfortable here and I don't. So obviously I don't deserve this. I'm here by mistake and it's only a matter of time before someone's going to knock on my door and tell me like, oh, we screwed up. And I think on top of that, you know, look, I don't blame my parents for being an alcoholic. I do think that, you know, they set up a set of expectations that I could just never meet. Like no matter what I did, no matter what school I got into or job I got or whatever, I was never getting that like attaboy pat on the back that I was so desperately looking for. So I was always chasing it and always coming up short. And I think that fueled the insecurity and my inability to just feel okay with who I was.
Yeah. What was your tipping point?
So I was a lawyer in San Francisco after law school for 2 years, drinking progressed, more blackouts, drinking alone.
How many times do you think you blacked out in your life?
Oh, I couldn't count. I mean, I blacked out almost every time I drank. Part of the allure was I'm going to start drinking and anything could happen. Anything can happen. Mm. That's part of the attraction. Like, I want to go on an adventure. I'm stuck in this law firm. I'm doing this law thing because I felt like I was supposed to do it. I have no love for it. I just couldn't wait until I could leave the office at an acceptable hour and go numb this pain. And I needed to like get out of my mind in order to survive on some level. I was chasing the blackouts. The blackouts weren't a negative byproduct.
That was the goal.
Yeah, it was the goal. It was the goal, just getting completely obliterated. So drinking escalates. I start drinking alone. I start hiding, you know, my drinks and my bottles from my roommate. I'm taking side streets, driving drunk in San Francisco, waking up the next morning, not remembering where I parked the car and having to walk around the neighborhood until I found it. I moved to Los Angeles and you can't get away with stuff in LA the way you can in other places. And it didn't take long before, you know, the cops started getting involved because this is before Uber and I was like driving drunk all the time. So I got two DUIs in 2 months. I rear-ended a woman at a stoplight. Mm. I blew a .29 and went to jail.
Oh my God, Rich.
And then literally within, it was like 6 or 8 weeks later, I got another one driving the wrong way down a one-way street in Beverly Hills at 3 a.m. and blew a .27. And that's where it all became very real. My boss found out.
And did you then, or do you now looking back, think it was suicidal behavior? Like I was kind of hoping that something bad would happen.
Mm. Yeah, not consciously suicidal, but you know, you don't do that kind of stuff without knowing that, you know, it's not going to go well on some level. And that right. speaks to the denial. Like I was like, I'll get away with this. It'll be okay. And just basically spinning the roulette wheel with your life.
I mean, you must be so relieved that you never hurt someone.
It's crazy that all of it wasn't worse than it was. So yeah, it all got real in LA. I was looking at jail time. I had to get these heavy lawyers involved. And your question being, what was the bottom or, you know, where, what was the tipping point? Truly, it was this marriage that went sideways on me where the woman that I had, quote unquote, gotten married to didn't want to sign the marriage certificate and ultimately left during the honeymoon. And I've never seen her since.
Wow.
It was a wedding that was attended by everybody in the world that I loved. I had like 13 groomsmen. It was a big deal. And it just...
And you loved her.
I thought I loved her then, but I didn't really know what love was. And I think she wanted to get out of this relationship and didn't have the fortitude to do it and was trying to get me to call it off. This was, you know, a seminal moment in my life that went sideways and it was utterly humiliating and unbelievably emotionally painful. And my only coping mechanism again was alcohol. Even though that was really truly my emotional bottom, I needed to continue to drink because the pain was so extreme. So I ended up drinking for another like 9 months or so. And this is when my parents, you know, started to really get involved and I ultimately get the tough love talk. And that's how I ended up at a treatment center in 1998. I thought I was going to do a 28-day inpatient thing. I ended up doing a 100-day inpatient thing.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that I did.
How did you pay for it?
You know, that's where my parents helped out. You know, I cashed out all my savings and my pension, whatever, there wasn't that much money. And my parents filled in the gap and helped pay for it. So they really, you know, came to my rescue in that regard. But, you know, it was a situation where I arrived thinking I was going to do a spin dry because I got to get back to my important law firm job. And it became a very different thing. After I kind of sobered up and detoxed there, you know, the gravity of my situation was becoming apparent and the denial was starting to drip away. And I realized, like, this is like no joke. Like, I wasn't in some spa. Like, this was a pretty hardcore place in the middle of nowhere in Oregon. And, you know, I was like, I better figure this out and make this work, because if I don't, my life is going to be a revolving door of institutions like this at best. And so I made a decision that I was going to, like, let go of my agenda and really, you know, ask for help and receive help and be honest. And so I started being honest with the counselors, telling people for the very first time, like, how I was living, what I was actually doing. And they said, look, I know you want to get out of here quickly, but we think you should stick around. Based upon what you're telling us, you have a case of alcoholism that we typically only see in lifelong drinkers, you know, men in their 60s. And if you don't sort this out, you're just going to go back to what you're doing and you're not going to live very long.
And you believed them.
I did. Yeah.
You could hear it.
The deadpan, you know, delivery of the truth, you know, really sunk in. And so I was like, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And I'll stay here as long as you think I need to stay here. And that literally saved my life.
What did you learn there that you wish everybody could know?
That's such a big question. You know, it was my introduction to living your life in accordance with spiritual principles, something that I had rebuked my entire life.
Did you go to church as a kid? Did you have any spirituality?
Yeah, I went to a Presbyterian church as a kid and did Sunday school, and I went to an Episcopalian, you know, elementary school, and I never connected with any of it. I just had such a hard time finding a way to relate to religion in any regard and was utterly dismissive of it. So there was no spiritual interest on my part whatsoever until I was introduced to non-denominational strain of spirituality in treatment, along with, you know, these 12 steps, which are essentially, you know, these tools for living that have, you know, not just saved my life, but continue to serve me on a daily basis. And they're really common sense principles, guideposts for how to live, which is essentially boils down to clean house, do an inventory on your behavior, you know, make amends to other people, practice gratitude, practice prayer and meditation, give back more than you get, and understand that your primary purpose is to help other people, specifically help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I've just found over the many years that I've participated in this program that when I put these principles first and I actually practice them, that everything in my life tends to go better and my peace of mind and my happiness is a lot higher. And it truly is, you know, what got me sober and continues to keep me sober.
You're not only sober, you're like a world-class athlete. So talk about that change, because you were like 50 pounds overweight.
So I get out of treatment and faced with how to live in the world again, which was really scary after being in a treatment center for 100 days where, like, I wish I could go back. Like, how great. You just sit around and talk about your issues and they feed you. It's
and
like
just
amazing,
be held,
you
know? And understood, yeah, and accepted.
Exactly.
I want to go.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Everybody should go. Then I'm like, oh man, like I get to make my own decisions now. And it was daunting. I ended up going back to that law firm who supported me when I was in treatment. And even though I had come to the realization that I had picked the wrong career for myself, at a minimum, I owed it to these people that supported me to go back and work there at least as long as I was away, and ended up doing that for another year before I ultimately, you know, decided I just couldn't work in that environment anymore and ended up getting out of that, but not abandoning being a lawyer altogether. The theme of the podcast being change, like, all these changes that I make, most of them are tiny little adjustments that take a long time. You know, there's the dramatic, like, I went to rehab, but, you know, okay, I quit the law firm. The phone would ring and say, can you help me with this thing? And I kind of cobbled together a solo law practice, working, you know, with some friends and some other people, not making very much money, and ultimately, you know, was able to kind of craft a career as an entertainment lawyer on my own terms. But because I was so unaccustomed to being self-employed. There's like an anxiety that comes with that. Like, I got to make this happen. Like, how is this going to work? How am I going to pay my bills? Like, I'm not just banking a paycheck every month. And so as sober as I was becoming, and the more I kind of embraced these principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a big blind spot, which was the extent to which I transferred a lot of those addictive tendencies onto career and really became very much a workaholic, to the point that I put on 50 pounds, I stopped exercising, I stopped doing the things that I enjoyed doing.
I mean, it was your first love. You rejected your first love.
I did. Yeah, I never swam anymore. I just wasn't really taking care of myself physically. And I was medicating myself with food. So yeah, I wasn't using drugs and alcohol, but I was still very much an alcoholic in other regards. At the same time, my life was getting better and better. So it was easy to overlook that I still had work to do. I met my wife, we were getting married, we're starting a family. Everything was kind of coming together in a beautiful way. But by the time I was 39, I was chubby, you know, overworked, junk food addicted dude, sliding into middle age. Kind of semi-depressed about my life choices. I was having another kind of existential crisis that collided with a health scare shortly before I turned 40, where I was walking up the staircase to our bedroom. I was too winded to make it all the way up. Like, I had to take a break. I had tightness in my chest. And that was a scary moment. As somebody who still, like, talk about denial, like, I still thought I was this Stanford swimmer. And when I would look in the mirror, I would see that person, even though in reality, I had become somebody entirely different from that. So that broke another layer of denial and was kind of a window into, you know, this reality that I was living, like health not going good. I had a belief, a faith in the power of these decisions to be these incredible, like, Archimedes levers on our life trajectory. And, you know, as I thought about that rehab experience and how potently that decision had changed me, I realized, like, oh, I could do that again. What can I do now to change the state that I'm in?
So I just want to flag that, like, change begets change. Like, yeah. The proof of any small, even the tiniest adjustment, the proof of that, like, sticking and making something positive happen in your life is in itself a new addiction.
That's true. I think that's very true.
Because then it's like, what could I do next?
Yeah.
Like, if I could do that, if I could go from being a complete drunk who was like a menace to society, who was a true danger to this person, then there must be there's a whole nother thing I could do and a thing after that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an astonishing proof point that most people never experience something that dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the truth is change and growth is available to all of us all the time. We just have to reach out for it. And why is it so elusive? Why is it so difficult even to make a tiny little lifestyle adjustment? In my case, I've always been motivated by pain. The fear of the unknown or of the change has to be overshadowed by the
fear of continuing.
Yeah, the discomfort with your current state, right? And you know, that, like, calibrating that has always been, it's like, I don't wake up and go, how can I be better? It's only when, like, you know, my head bangs up against the wall 10,000 times and it becomes impossible to continue. So why is that? Why can't we all spare ourselves all of the trauma and the pain that comes with, you know, chasing the wrong thing for too long, and just avail ourselves of the opportunities and change that are truly always available to us, whether it's through a book or a podcast or a documentary or a simple lifestyle tweak. I'm going to wake up 10 minutes earlier today, or I'm going to meditate for 5 minutes, or I'm not going to take that drink at the party tonight. All of these things are things that we can all do, and yet they're so difficult for most people, myself included.
I know. And it's very comparable to parenting, where it's like, I would like to save you, child, person I love more than anyone else ever could or will. I would like to save you from this pain. But pain, in some ways, is the only teacher. Like, I was thinking in your case, like love saves, Kinda, but not quite enough. Like, your dad couldn't save you. And Julie, love of your life, could not save you. And maybe pain saves. Maybe the pain has this critical function as the ultimate change agent, even greater than love.
I think that's true. I mean, it's certainly true from an evolutionary point of view. We have pain receptors for a reason, to protect us, right? So if the pain becomes so severe, whether it's emotional or physical, we're compelled to redirect in some way.
Right. Okay, so you start working out again.
Right. So I make this decision that I'm going to change my relationship to my physical self and to my relationship with food in the same way that I reconfigured my relationship with drugs and alcohol. And I go on this journey with this. Ultimately, you know, I end up adopting this plant-based diet. I have this resurgence of vitality. I start getting interested in moving my body again, something I hadn't done in quite some time. And it all began very casually. I just pulled an old pair of shoes out of the closet and started jogging once in a while. And I went back to the pool. And Julie bought me a bike for my 40th birthday. And I was having a good old time.
Do you remember being in the pool for the first time and thinking like, oh, hey, old friend?
Yes. And it's like, why haven't I been doing this? Not only did it connect me with my youth, it was just a reminder that it's the simplest things in life that bring me joy. You know, joy doesn't come with the new Carly's. It comes with the feeling of the sun on my shoulders on a on a trail run or something that's very primal and natural and free.
Right.
And, you know, rediscovering that and doubling down on it was like an epiphany for me. And I remember like thinking, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing with my life right now. I know I'm not happy in this career path. I don't know what the way forward is, but I do know that doing these things, these physical activities, is like nourishment that I've missed in my life. And I made a promise to myself, no matter what, I'm going to prioritize this. Not that I had any inkling of a sense that I wanted to be competitive as an athlete, just that I wanted to connect with my physical body in this way because it was reminding me of these things that have brought me joy as a young person. So it was this kind of, you know, childlike reconnection process. Yeah.
And there's a lot of nature in the way you exercise.
I live in a place that you've been in my house. It's like surrounded by nature and trails. I'd lived here for quite some time, had never gone on a hike ever, you know, and then suddenly I'm out on these trails.
People live where you live.
I know. And I'm like, I can't believe all of this stuff is here and I've never even known about it.
Right. For the price of a pair of shoes, you can
have
it. So would you consider your greatest athletic achievement like a certain race, a certain completing something, winning something, or just adopting the daily practice?
The daily practice. You know, the training and the races have been teachers, but they're really just this lattice work, like this framework for, you know, what I consider to be a spiritual and emotional journey. Yes, it's physical, but the reason that I really began to explore it was that the more time I spent alone out in nature doing these things, you know, just connecting with my breath and hearing nothing but, you know, my heart beating, was like this active meditation that helped me process all of these strange emotions that I was having and helped me develop some clarity about, you know, where I wanted my life to head. And you know, those are big questions. You don't just get out a whiteboard and figure it out. Like I needed time. And that for me was, you know, these experiences in nature were my vehicle for sorting that out.
Do you love yourself now? Are you good to yourself?
You say that and it's like I have this like bristle, like do I love myself? Am I comfortable saying that? I still have my demons. You know, I still battle with insecurity and I battle with people pleasing and setting healthy boundaries and doing things that people that love themselves do. Like it's a practice. Like I don't wake up naturally grateful. I become grateful as a result of doing certain things, you know, every day to remind me of, you know, the bounty of my life. So I do love myself, but loving myself requires work.
If you had to remind people who are listening to this about you know, two or three things that are super fundamental to change, what would they be?
No matter how far down you are, no matter how hopeless you feel your predicament to be, there is always hope, and there is always an action that you can take to shift your perspective and your reality. So it's important to anybody who feels stuck to understand that there is a path forward and that there is light at the end of the tunnel, as trite as that may sound. And the important thing to do is to first recognize that you need help, that you're suffering. Second, to find a way to communicate that to another human being, hopefully somebody that you trust and respect who's in your circle. And if not, finding somebody else that you feel like you can be honest with, and share with another human being what you're going through. Get over the fear or the shame that you're harboring that's keeping you isolated from communicating effectively with somebody else, because change, healing, growth all begins with that one-on-one interaction, honest interaction with another human being. So it's about asking for help, and then even harder, if you're like me, being willing to accept that help when it's offered, to have the humility to say, I don't know what I'm doing, or I'm in pain, or I need help. Help me figure out how to do this. Tell me what to do, and then to actually do it. So we all get wrapped up in these romantic stories of dramatic change with individuals where it looks like they did it easily and it all happened overnight, and that's not how change works. Change works in these micro adjustments that you make consistently over time, such that during the process of change, you're not even perceptibly aware that you actually are changing. So it's not about the destination or the person you're trying to become, but being rather focused on what you're doing every day. What decisions are you making? And calibrating them against the person you want to be, the person you aspire to be, and the person you once were. And I think the more you can root yourself in that process, ask for help, accept that help, take these tiny actions, and over time, I think you will be amazed at your own inherent ability to shift your reality.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly.
I'm so grateful to Rich for sharing every detail of his story. There are three takeaways for me today, each enormous in scope and impact. One, there is a road out. People recover. They are doing it right now, all around us, against staggering odds. Two, you have to tell someone. We are each other's best bet. Three, change is only grand in retrospect. Day by day, it's small choices and tiny adjustments. Believe in the incremental. Thank you so much to Rich Roll. Thank you, Susan George, who's the producer of this podcast, and Dean Kateri, who's the sound engineer. Of course, I want to thank Arthur Vining Davis Foundations again. And I want to shout out to everybody who is posting about Kelly Corrigan Wonders on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. We see them all, we love them all, and we appreciate them all. I'll see you next week on Kelly Corrigan Wonders.